Well, welcome to the ESI seminar, and it's good to see some people here, and we have had a little bit of a scheduling problem, but I'm glad we could get things going today, and it's especially a pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Joe Marriott, who's a contractor at NETL. He's been there for about 2.5 years. We're actually working with Booz Allen Hamilton. And he's going to talk to us today about life cycle analysis. Joe, I'm pleased to say, is a thorough alumnus of Carnegie Mellon. He got
all three.
Bachelor's degree in electrical engineering here, a master's degree in civil and environmental, an EPP, and a PhD in civil and environmental, an EPP, as well in 2006. He has been a member of the Green Design Institute at Carnegie Mellon, and spent a couple of years at the University of Pittsburgh in a research academic position as well. He's got interests basically in environmental science, energy systems, and he's in a really good position to give us an idea of the work on life cycle analysis at NETL. So, Joe, it's all yours.
All right. Okay, so I want to warn everybody about the vibe, and Larry and I talked about this earlier. There are a lot of results in this presentation. If you scanned through the PDF at all, it might have been a bit overwhelming. I do not intend to spend a lot of time on any given number. All those numbers are in there to kind of give you a sense for the type of work that we're doing, the kind of breadth of technologies that we touch on. But if you have questions on any particular result, any particular technology, feel free to poke at it. There's a reasonable chance that I can answer that question. Okay, so first, as a representative of the lab, I need to give everybody an overview of NETL. NETL is a DOE laboratory. Mission is advancing energy options to fuel our economy, strengthen security, and improve our environment. Its primary focus is in western Pennsylvania, West Virginia. So the majority of federal employees are located in those facilities. It is a federally owned, federally operated lab, which means that the lab employees are actually federal employees, which is different from many of the other DOE labs. Okay, so here's what I intend to do today. I'm going to give everyone a brief sense for what life cycle analysis is, go over some tools that NETL has built to kind of engage the community, go over some examples, and this is where the vast majority of those numbers I was referring to are, go over some example life cycle analyses that we've done, and then talk a little bit about some forthcoming things that we have coming out, and then item number 4.2 is probably the area where there's the most likelihood for kind of engagement with an academic community. And so I'll be interested. I'm not sure I can even get across enough detail, but if folks are interested in that particular thing, I'm happy to kind of stick around and talk about it and get feedback. Okay. So the purpose of the Energy Systems LCA program at NETL, first and foremost, it's to produce energy systems LCAs, which is sort of a dull objective, but it is what pays the bills. And the foremost objective of producing those is to inform and defend the technology programs at the lab. And those technology programs, just give you some examples. You know, there's a turbine technology program. There's a carbon sequestration and utilization program. A whole range of research programs, and our objective is to kind of inform those programs, guide them from a kind of high-level environmental view, and make recommendations for other things they might look at. A kind of secondary objective, two secondary objectives, I guess, are to kind of improve life cycle assessment done at the lab, and therefore increase the visibility of the laboratory doing life cycle assessments. And there's a whole range of different... Yeah.
By the way, we're on slide 4.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yes. I'll try to do a better job of referring to slide numbers. Thank you. On slide 4, item 2. And this involves expanding inventories, characterizing our uncertainty, building flexible and dynamic models. And then the third thing is enhancing interpretation. Traditionally, environmental life cycle assessment results tend to be pretty static. They tend to be point estimates, and even if we're doing comparisons, there isn't a lot of interesting interpretation that's done. And so we're trying to expand our ability to interpret these results. and supporting that, NETL has a library of over 300 custom unit processes, dozens of models, so we can kind of quickly, you know, pull Legos out of the bag and build new things. Okay, so some definitions of LCA. For chemical engineers, you know, maybe best to think of it as a mass and energy balance. There's a black box. We try to measure what goes in, what comes out. We just do that on a kind of wider system boundaries than your sort of typical chemical engineering process, where you might be way down in a black box. We kind of expand and look at inputs to those processes, what comes out of those processes, and what happens to the products that you produce once you've produced them. Key to doing this analysis is developing what we call a functional unit, basically determining what your denominator is. Okay, if you're going to determine impact of some sort on the numerator, you need to have a common denominator so that you can compare these things. And so our challenge as life cycle assessment engineers is to develop reasonable functional units that are in fact comparable. And you know, even the functional units that we have are in fact challenging. This 1 megawatt hour, for anyone who has any sense of power engineering, knows that all megawatt hours are in fact not created equal, that they're not in fact a common denominator. A megawatt hour produced by wind and a megawatt hour produced by nuclear or coal are not identical from a system, a power systems perspective. But we would have to qualify this functional unit with so many things as to make it unusable and uncomparable to anything. So, you know, we do back off that a little bit. On the bottom here of slide 5, all the different things we're collecting data on. Okay, so the focus of this talk, you'll see, is on greenhouse gases, just because it is something that everyone has a sense of. But we're really collecting information on a huge variety of environmental factors and also economic factors. And so we are able to compare, say, greenhouse gases against criteria air pollutants, greenhouse gases against costs, give ourselves more ability to compare different options. Okay. Slide 6 is not intended to be readable, which, is, believe it or not, is a common theme in this presentation. Many of these things are not intended to be readable, but this is an example of the sort of information that we're collecting. You know, back on slide 5, you have, you know, 5 blue boxes, and it looks overly simplistic. The reality is that figuring out what these inputs and outputs are on a common basis can be pretty complicated. So what you're looking at here is what we call a unit process. This is for gaseous diffusion uranium enrichment, basically the process by which we upgrade UF6 to fuel, basically, for nuclear power. And what you see on the bottom are the list of parameters, basically the ways in which we manipulate the raw data that we've collected, say from an environmental impact statement or from someone else's chemical engineering study, the way we manipulate that base data into our reference flow or functional unit. And on slide 7, even at a higher view, this is hooking all the boxes together into a life cycle process flow. And this is the tool we use. It's called Gabby. You know, every field has their own tool. This is ours. And actually, there are multiple flavors. This just happens to be the one you use. But you get a sense here that the sort of product of interest on slide 7 is the petroleum refinery operations process, sort of in the middle of the slide. And then everything else you see on that slide, all the other boxes, are inputs to that process. So you see, you know, crude oil going in there, other raw materials. And then you see, you don't hear, but you see, you would see the output from that process heading off into a combustion or a transport process. Okay, so unfortunately, that's all you're getting on life cycle analysis. You know, I think since you're all chemical engineers, you can understand it as basically just a process flow at a high level, and we don't need to go into any more detail than that because I do have a lot of other stuff to get to. So the second item on the agenda, and I'm on slide 8, is different tools that NETL has produced, either on its own or in collaboration with other entities, to allow the public access to all that information. Right? Our job is to do the nuts and bolts stuff, produce these unit processes, connect them all in the right way, but then we need to produce tools so that other people can explore that stuff. Right? We're a publicly funded entity. We need to give the user community access to this information. So here's one of those tools. Called the Power Life Cycle Analysis Tool, or LCAT. And basically, this is built in collaboration with Sandia. It's an ongoing partnership, and the platform is PowerSim. It's probably not the ideal platform for a tool like this, but we've learned a heck of a lot by putting it together. And basically what we're doing with this tool is allowing users to explore all the various lifecycle assessments that we've done, both from an environmental and a cost perspective, and allowing them access to individual parameters, right? So I can say, if I change the capital cost of this technology, how will the cost of electricity increase with this technology relative to its sort of competitive baseload options? And then on the environmental side, which I cut, apparently... we can do the same sorts of things. Look at greenhouse gases versus criteria air pollutants from various technologies. We're building in the capability to allow flexibility of those environmental parameters at the same time. And so a user could come in here and figure out, all right, what is, given my set of criteria, my set of parameters, what is a better technology option? Is it integrated gasification combined cycle? Is it supercritical PC? Is it nuclear? And we can manipulate these parameters to kind of show you that information. Okay, another tool, and this one completely different. This was developed ongoing partnership again with RAND Corporation, this is called CUBE, the Calculating Uncertainty in Biomass Emissions. Believe it or not, I had to look that up yesterday. Until yesterday, I just called it CUBE. But it is, in fact, Calculating Uncertainty in Biomass Emissions. And basically, what this allows users to do is explore the uncertainty and variability associated with energy feedstocks, bio-based energy feedstocks. And this runs the gamut, you can see across the bottom, from... deliberately cultivated energy crops, like a switchgrass or a hybrid poplar, all the way to something like forest residue, where you're basically clearing, U.S. Forest Service is collecting brush to prevent forest fires, and you can transport that and burn it or, I guess, theoretically gasify it. And what this tool, and it's an Analytica-based tool, this probably is the ideal platform. What this tool allows you to do is explore the greenhouse gas emissions, upstream greenhouse gas emissions. So this is prior to combusting it or gasifying it in any sort of energy conversion facility, the upstream emissions from those biomass feedstocks. And what you see here and what the tool basically allows you to figure out is that greenhouse gas emissions are highly dependent on where you're putting them, right, what type of land you're putting them on, and then the yield you're going to get from that land. And, you know, the common sort of conventional wisdom is that biomass is either there's a carbon benefit, right, we're sort of sequestering carbon, or at the very least it's carbon neutral. And what CUBE tells us is that, in fact, is not true. You know, there are a lot of biomass options which are carbon positive. And we need to be careful about where we put biomass and the type of biomass that we grow on different types of land in order to minimize the carbon footprint of actually cultivating these crops. All right. I'm going a million miles an hour here. If you have any questions, stop me. It'll allow me to take a breath.
Slide 10.
What's that?
Slide 10.
Oh, yeah, and we're on slide 10. Okay, thank you. Okay, another tool. And this one... again, in the kind of genre of informing either LCA practitioners or the public about life cycle issues, we refer to anything kind of upstream of an energy conversion facility as upstream, right? So the cultivation of a crop, the extraction of a raw material, that's upstream. Okay? And lots of times at the lab or outside the lab, we have folks who are working in very detailed models of some sort of energy conversion process, right? So they're working on a coal and biomass FT process to produce jet fuel or diesel. And they know a lot about that process, but they basically cut their boundaries with delivered material. The materials are sort of magically appears at their plant gate. And what this tool allows you to do is add on the upstream life cycle information to your facility. So if I'm going to be mining coal, if I'm going to be cultivating biomass, this tells me what my life cycle adder is for a particular emission. So it gives users who aren't informed about life cycle assessment a kind of more complete picture of the environmental impact of their process. And again, it's completely flexible, so you can go in and change parameters. So if you think, my process is going to be using a bituminous instead of a subbituminous coal, but it's going to be a gassy coal, or it has a higher sulfur content, or it's going to be transported 1,000 miles instead of 200 miles, you can go in and change those things and kind of get an accurate representation of what it's going to cost you from an environmental perspective to get your raw materials to your plant gate. And again, give you a more complete picture of what the environmental impact is. Okay. I'm going to run over here and grab water before I get into... So now I'm going to get into a big set of life cycle assessment examples that we've worked on mostly within the last year and a half. They're in no particular order. This one... for folks who are in Western Pennsylvania or Pennsylvania in general, even tangentially related, doing research related to energy, probably know something about Marcellus Shale and unconventional natural gas and kind of the, we'll call it a controversy going on around what is the environmental footprint of natural gas power? Is it green or not? And so we were asked to weigh in on that particular question. And in doing so, built this kind of high-level life cycle assessment model that you see here. And one thing I want everyone to see here that on slide 12, the green box is kind of the what most folks look at. That's the energy conversion facility. That's the power plant. And granted, that's where the majority of the impact tends to come. It's a combustion process. That's where you're going to find the impacts. But the complexity of this model and the flexibility of this model actually comes in the upstream portion. What we were really focusing on was characterizing the upstream factors. And we've got basically, at this point, seven versions of the blue boxes to characterize seven different flavors, we call them, of natural gas. So Marcellus Shale, Barnett Shale, coal bed methane, onshore conventional, offshore conventional, associated gas. I'm probably forgetting one there. But anyway, the complexity of this model lies in drilling down into the processes associated with extracting that fuel. And it turns out there are a lot of emissions associated with that extraction. And so these are... what we call drill down. This is the level of detail that a process model like the one you just saw allows you to get. Okay, so these are upstream emissions. Right? These are the emissions that it takes to get natural gas out of the ground and to a plant gate. So the inefficiency, relative inefficiency or efficiency of combustion and the CO2 emissions associated with combustion are not included in these results. The key thing here, and this is... part of our contribution to the debate about the relative impact of Marcellus Shale versus any other type of conventional gas is that we actually see an upstream profile for natural gas that is effectively equivalent to that of Marcellus Shale. The greenhouse gas footprint of Marcellus Shale, and this is true whether it's from Barnett, we haven't modeled Haynesville explicitly, but whether it's Barnett or Marcellus, the footprint tends to be about the same as onshore conventional, which was really surprising. And the reason, and you can see it, no, you don't see it here, maybe somewhere else. The reason for that is that while the episodic emissions, basically the burps of methane that come out when you're completing a well, are larger for shale plays, the production rates are also higher, right? So calling users are covering my results. While the numerator of shale gas is higher, the denominator is also bigger, right? So we get this kind of, we just tend to produce a lot more with shale. And so the number becomes effectively equivalent to that of onshore gas, which has relatively low emissions, but also relatively low production rates because, we have all these wells that have been operation for 30 years and, they've got these, they're on the bottom end of their supply curves. And so you get these relatively high emissions. Okay. This is one of those example number slides, slide 14. Basically, this is our sensitivity analysis. Every one of these models, our seven flavors of natural gas, is completely parameterized to kind of the things that matter. And these are tornado diagrams which explain which things matter the most. And
as we might expect, given what I was just saying about the relative impact of onshore versus shale, the production rate is what matters most, right? The production rate, just driving the denominator, is the key to figuring out what the footprint of gas is. All right, so we'll just move on from there. Slide 18, and this is a point that gets lost consistently in the debate about, natural gas versus coal, which saying natural gas versus coal can get me in trouble, but Tim, forgive me. The bottom line is that it doesn't matter how high your footprint is for extracting natural gas. The reality is you're putting it into a facility with a, in general, higher efficiency, and it's just a much lower carbon content fuel, right? So the figure on the left of slide 15, our coal options are on the left, and we've got kind of a fleet base load. This is a characterization of the entire installed coal fleet, and then we've got kind of new coal options. Basically a modern coal facility, which looks a lot like the fleet from a carbon perspective, IGCC and SCPC. And those tend to be double the emissions from a baseload natural gas facility, right? So even though the contribution of the what we call raw material acquisition and raw material transport tends to be higher than for coal, the emissions at combustion when you're converting to power overwhelm this kind of decision. That changes, of course, if you can capture the carbon at combustion. One interesting thing that you get from a life cycle assessment perspective is that if you install carbon capture, you actually reduce the efficiency of your combustion process, right? You have to pull in more coal to get the same unit power output. So if you compare the IGCC with carbon capture to the IGCC without, you'll see that, in fact, the raw material acquisition number goes up, although we're capturing 90% of the carbon, so the overall number is lower. And on the right, you see a figure which basically just says that this result is not sensitive to global warming potential or global warming potential time horizon. So I don't know how much climate science there is here, but greenhouse gases have basically a time horizon to put them on a carbon dioxide equivalent, right? Basically allow you to put methane, SF6, N2O, and carbon dioxide all on a common basis. Because these are molecules with different lifetimes in the atmosphere, if you are concerned about a 20-year time horizon versus a 100-year time horizon, those different molecules have different global warming potentials. So methane is shorter lived, so it has a higher global warming potential on a shorter time frame. Either way, what we found is that our results, where coal has higher greenhouse gas emissions than natural gas, even from a life cycle perspective, are robust to choice of global warming potential year time frame. Okay, jumping to a different process, so completely different process. This is now a process for combining coal and biomass in a Fischer-Tropsch process to produce jet fuel. The primary customer for this being the Department of Defense. The reason why is that there is a regulation inside the 2007 Energy Independence and Security Act, which says that if the Department of Defense, or any government organization for that matter, is going to purchase an alternative jet fuel, it needs to have a carbon footprint, a life cycle carbon footprint, less than domestic petroleum. Okay, so it's sort of a check, right? Like, you can buy alternative fuel, make it out of coal, make it out of biomass, make it out of natural gas, I don't care. It just has to have a greenhouse gas footprint less than conventional petroleum. Now, from an environmental perspective, that's not really a high bar, right? I mean, we're still talking about combusting petroleum, but with by manipulating your carbon capture percentage or those sorts of things, or the percentage of biomass, you can get below this kind of baseline and say that for a particular mix of coal and biomass, I actually have a fuel which is less greenhouse gases than conventional petroleum. And this is the high-level process flow for that process. Underlying that high-level model is, in fact, some actual chemical engineering. I mean, we do a lot of data collection from public sources, right? Someone has already done a high-level report. We just pull that information in. But for something like an FT process or power gasification, we do the Aspen modeling. NETL does the Aspen modeling itself, right? So we're doing complete mass and energy balances of these facilities across a whole variety of scenarios to produce the emissions from the energy conversion facility, which tend to matter the most. So, you can see this is a dual-fed coal and biomass FT facility. FT jet coming out of the bottom of slide 17. This is officially SPK1. It is effectively equivalent to conventional jet fuel. So there is a lot of underlying data. In this particular study, what we did was attached basically a stochastic model, Monte Carlo, to all the parameters within our model. Okay, so we're basically able to, do 1,000 iterations of the ranges on all of our parameters to see if any of the parameters that we actually collect the data on matter. Interesting thing for this particular study, and the greenhouse gas results are on the top of slide 18. For any given scenario, so we can look at the 0% biomass, and so a 0% biomass is effectively a CTL process, right? It's a coal to liquids process. The allocation method, and I'll talk say in a minute what allocation method is. The allocation method is the driver for whether or not you're above or below the conventional jet fuel baseline, which is kind of a bizarre place to be in. So the variability and uncertainty associated with the greenhouse gas emissions from our processes are tiny. It turns out we understand this process really well, right? The carbon comes in, the carbon goes out. We understand that very well. Right? So there's very little uncertainty, right? However, when I am producing jet fuel in an FT process, I need to do co-product allocation. Everyone should understand from a mass and energy balance perspective, if my product of interest is jet fuel, I can't optimize my FT facility to produce 100% jet, right? It just chemically, I would have to put way, way, way too much energy into that facility to get 100% jet out. So instead what I do is I produce other products. And so I produce diesel, I produce naphtha, I can produce excess electricity. And then because we are heading into a carbon-constrained world, I have a fifth co-product, which is carbon dioxide. Right? So carbon dioxide is not necessarily a waste stream because we have carbon capture, utilization, and storage, or CO2 EOR. Right? So I can take my carbon dioxide, send it to a major oil player, and say, use this CO2 to jam into the ground to push more oil out. Now I have even more co-products. Right? So in addition to my FT jet, I have this crude coming out of the ground. My system has expanded, so I've got this crude coming out of the ground. That crude also produces jet fuel. Right, so now I have these two products of interest for the same product, right? FT jet and crude jet. And now I have to take the carbon balance from that entire system and allocate it across all the various products. So now my products are electricity, FT diesel, FT naphtha, FT jet, conventional jet, conventional naphtha, conventional diesel, and electricity. In addition, maybe a little hydrogen, maybe a little bit more CO2. And I have to allocate the system impacts across all of those different products. And the method by which I do that really matters. It turns out if I do system expansion, if I basically just expand my boundaries to incorporate all that impact and then divide them across all the products, basically think of it as just taking the total sum of impact divided by the total number of products, I get results above the baseline. If I do an energy-based allocation, where I actually take the energy content of each of these different products and allocate that way, I'm below the baseline. So if I am interested in producing, say, a CTL facility, right? I want to produce a coal-only jet fuel for the Air Force, whether or not I meet the law, right? Section 526 of the Security Act depends not on my technology. It depends on my accounting method, which is really problematic from a policy perspective, because the EPA is going to come into this guy's process and say, your process looks great. If you want to meet the baseline, just change your accounting method, and you'll hit the baseline. The real answer depends on your perspective. The system expansion is probably closer to kind of the marginal impact, the next unit of energy that comes onto the market. energy is probably closer to the long run. But in the transition time, you know, in kind of a 5-10 year time frame, we really don't know where the actual footprint of that gas is, that fuel is going to be. Anyway, so I got about 10 minutes.
We'll keep going. Like I said, I could talk for hours about any of these numbers, but there's way too many more numbers to present. I'll try and speed it up on the rest of them. Okay, so slide 19, we can drill into the detail on these and tell you exactly where the impact is coming from, telling you which parameters matter. What we don't show here, if we actually
parameterized the accounting method, the co-product allocation method, that would far and away be the primary driver of this process, right? You just saw that in the previous result. The
accounting method is what's driving this result. Okay,
different process entirely. Nuclear power.
Why is the traditional fossil lab looking at nuclear power?
Well, it turns out that we need to understand the impact of a whole range of different energy technologies in order to kind of guide the programs effectively. Right? What price points are we heading for? What greenhouse gas footprints are we heading for? And so it's important to characterize a whole range of different technologies. So we looked at life cycle we looked at nuclear power. This is the high level process flow diagram. And we looked at both existing and kind of next-gen nuclear power. What we don't have here is small modular reactors. There's not a lot of data for them. It's not entirely clear what the applications for those sorts of units will be. So these are big sort of 1,000 to 2,000 megawatt types of units. One that characterizes all of the existing fleet, kind of the average of the 104 existing reactors. And then a second which characterizes kind of a Westinghouse AP1000 type of unit. And what we see here, first of all, these are tiny greenhouse gas numbers, right? Relative to coal, which is around 1,000, 1,400, these are tiny greenhouse gas numbers. So let's just say that as the baseline. These are small numbers. If I want to improve nuclear power, what do I do? Well, I mean, switching technologies helps, but it doesn't help nearly as much as changing my enrichment method. It turns out in the United States, we use among the kind of least efficient enrichment method possible, which is gaseous diffusion. In Europe, Japan, there tends to be a lot more enrichment with centrifuge enrichment, which is a much more energy efficient process. You don't have to plug in nearly as much power to get that to get your fuel out. And so if we wanted to improve the greenhouse gas footprint of nuclear power, rather than upgrading plants to Gen 3, what we should just do is change our enrichment method. We also have life cycle cost results. For this work, we went to a range of experts, MIT, Nuclear Energy Institute, EPRI, and got feedback from them as to what the reasonable parameters would be, cost of a plant, cost of operating, to get a range of costs on this electricity. And unfortunately, if what you're looking for is an objective, how low does my power have to be to compete with nuclear? Turns out nuclear can be anywhere from, say, $2 per megawatt hour to $200 per megawatt hour, depending on your assumptions about the risk-averse nature of your investor, how much construction is going to cost you. It's highly dependent. So anyone who tells you they know the nuclear cost of power, they're lying. The delta on cost is order of magnitude. Two orders of magnitude, it turns out. One. Right, 20. Okay. Next. Life cycle process flow for retrofit co-fire. And I'm on slide,
22.
No, you're right. They're just really fuzzy. So I'm only about halfway through. I got 5 minutes to go. That's just perfect.
We've got lots of time.
Yeah?
Take your time.
Well, yeah. So the CBTL process we looked at before, combined coal and biomass. Here we shove them through power. Okay? Basically, I guess we didn't gasify. This is basically taking both of those things and firing them in a boiler, okay, across a whole range of different options. The objective here is to look at whether or not injecting biomass into the coal fleet, whether it's new or existing coal, helps from a greenhouse gas perspective, right? Given the variability that we saw with the upstream emissions of biomass, does putting biomass into the coal fleet help? Does it get greenhouse gas improvement?
And, of course, the model is very detailed, so we have the ability to drill way down. And here are the results. This was...
we did this work in about a month, tacking all these different results together. And so across the bottom of slide 25, you see the range of technologies we looked at. So we looked at an existing PC plant.
We looked at a new plant, a new supercritical plant, a new circulating fluidized bed plant.
And then we also compared it to CBTL. Basically, what if we produced fuel instead of power? Is that a better or worse use than using the biomass for power? And I will say, sort of cautionary note, these things, even though they are, in fact, on a megajoule basis, are not comparable, right? So I'm producing a megajoule of electricity and a megajoule of fuel. The end-use efficiencies of those two things are obviously going to be very different and will drive these results in very different directions. So cautionary note, don't directly compare the bars at the far right with the bars on the left. But what do we see here? There's only a tiny bit of variability introduced because the results here are dominated by combustion. In order to get reasonable greenhouse gas performance, you need to capture that CO2 from your power plants. The biomass is having a relatively small effect relative to carbon capture, right? And that should not be a surprise. We're talking about injection of 10 to 20% on an energy basis of biomass versus capturing 90% of the carbon from the flue gas, right? So, you know, obviously the carbon capture scenarios are going to be better from a greenhouse gas perspective. It turns out whether you simply store the carbon or whether you utilize the carbon in something like an EOR process is very important, right? So you see on, say, the coal-only existing case, CCS, carbon capture and storage, versus CCUS, carbon capture utilization and storage, basically the difference between EOR and non-EOR, is critical to whether or not, or is critical in driving the greenhouse gas results, right? I get much better performance if I pull out more, if I push out more petroleum and then allocate some of my impact to that petroleum. I mean, it's an accounting thing, right? By expanding the boundary to include petroleum coming out of the ground, I lower my impact. Just a time, we'll move on. We also did cost of electricity or required selling price for these fuels. And then, and this is a real eye chart, on slide 27, we basically calculated the cost of abatement, right? Life cycle greenhouse gases versus what it costs to produce that fuel. And, you know, we assume that we're going to have a steady state carbon price of maybe, let's just say $30, right? So imagine a $30 carbon price relative to this cost of abatement that you're seeing at the top of slide 27. You don't see a lot of numbers below $30, right? Unless we're doing CO2 EOR, right? So it turns out that to get cost-effective abatement, I really need to use that CO2 to do something. You know, from a sort of global perspective, pushing more petroleum out of the ground isn't the best thing to do with that fuel, but it certainly is cost-effective from an abatement perspective. Better than simply injecting more biomass. Better than simply capturing the carbon and storing it. A nice thing that our work allows us to do, because we are putting everything on a common basis, where we can compare power technologies of a huge range of power technologies. So everything from fleet gas and fleet coal, basically all the power plants currently installed in the United States, versus things all the way down to geothermal, solar thermal, nuclear, wind, on and offshore. And put those things on a common basis, both from a greenhouse gas perspective and a cost perspective. And it allows us to produce kind of neat figures like this, another eye chart, where we put all these options on a dual axis and say, all right, I want to be here, right? I want to be in lower left quadrant of slide. No one can read that number, right? That's the blob of pixels. Is that 29?
29.
All right. We want to be in the sort of lower left quadrant here. We want to have cheap power that's low carbon, right? And not a lot sitting there, unfortunately. Fleet gas, sadly, is kind of our best bet. As I go to lower carbon or higher carbon or more expensive options, I can get low carbon performance, but higher carbon tends to be cheaper,
which is pretty unfortunate. All right, and so there's a series of these as we put, this is for the co-firing cases, as we put all those co-firing options up in comparison with how the fleet currently looks or with other alternatives, we see that all these co-firing options are sitting up kind of where the existing fleet is, right? There's not a lot of improvement. Now, if I capture and utilize that carbon, I start to see some neat performance, right? I get relatively cheap, good greenhouse gas performance if I can capture that carbon and use it for CO2 EOR. The assumption here being that I make money off of selling the EOR operators my carbon. Slide 32, this is everything on the same basis. Again, you know, these red options from a cost and greenhouse gas perspective are our best options, and those are, in fact, 0% biomass, 90% carbon capture, and utilization of that carbon to produce EOR conventional petroleum. Okay. Wind farm, and I put the wind picture on the front of this, which is sort of, you know, comes way here at the end, but this is the process flow diagram for wind. You know, unlike coal or natural gas or biomass, there is no material acquisition here, right? There's no fuel I'm pulling out of the ground. The wind is free, which is nice. I do have to manufacture these things, and that is, in fact, where most of the impact of a sort of conventional thinking wind farm comes from. And you get this really nice greenhouse gas performance on slide 34 on the left. If we look at standalone conventional or advanced wind power, greenhouse gas performance orders of magnitude less than conventional fossil plants. Unfortunately, there's this kind of sticky issue of the availability of wind power. And here we're talking about not the sort of short-term variability of wind power, although there is that, right? Gusts of wind happen, and wind power goes up marginally. Lots of people put on their lights, and the wind power can't sort of keep up. There's that sort of short-term variability. But here what we're talking about is kind of longer-term availability. Over a 30-year lifetime of this plant, of this wind turbine, it's only going to be available 30 to 40% of the time. Right? And so if I install a megawatt of power, I need to have something else there to provide the power if I'm going to sort of ensure 100% availability. And our electricity system is ridiculously reliable. And so... You know, the power system operators have a kind of vested interest in keeping it that way. And so the real greenhouse gas footprint is not these kind of lower numbers, but instead think about a simple cycle gas turbine co-fired with wind, right? That's a better way to think about the system. These wind turbines have to exist with some sort of system that's going to provide system availability. Okay. Oh, great. Okay, so I'm at the end of the examples. I won't really stop for questions because I do want to talk about this. But again, if anyone has any questions on any of these studies, any of the ridiculous amount of detail that you did see, please contact either myself or Tim Scone, and we'd be more than happy to answer questions. So, you know, if any of these things are right in someone's research wheelhouse, please come and talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. Get more data is always our desire. But let me talk about this, because I think this is kind of an interesting piece of work and does kind of relate to this way in the detail process modeling that chemical engineers sort of live and breathe with versus the higher level process flow that the world that I tend to live in. So I have been tasked, and NETL would like to build, a dynamic coal and biomass power plant with various emission control options. Okay, so traditionally what happens is that NETL says, okay, we'd like to do a life cycle assessment of a supercritical plant. Okay, so they go to the, you know, chemical engineering guys, the Aspen modelers, and the Aspen modelers, you know, and this will sort of display my ignorance about chemical engineering in general. I imagine them just connecting boxes together and their job is over. But so they sit down and they do some Aspen modeling and kind of wave their hands, and numbers come out. And we plug those numbers into a single box in our life cycle assessment, connect other boxes to them, and we get an answer. So we've been very lucky in that we have kind of high certainty on the emissions coming out of these processes, right? Because there's a mass and energy balance sitting behind it. The problem is that those things are costly, right? Producing a Aspen model with high level of certainty for every potential variation for a suite of technologies is really expensive. And I've got a high-level process flow diagram on slide 36, which gives you a sense for some of the variability, although not nearly all of it.
There are at least hundreds, potentially thousands, of potential permutations of the emissions from a given power plant, right?
Every time I change a feedstock percentage, even slightly, every time I change the characteristics of that feedstock, even slightly, I change the combustion characteristics, right? So I could be putting in a higher carbon content fuel, a higher sulfur content fuel. I could be putting in switchgrass rather than hybrid poplar. Excuse me. And every time I change that feedstock, the combustion performance of my facility changes. Now, excuse me. If we only care about carbon balance, this would be easy. I could do that, right? And I'm not even that good at math. Carbon's easy, right? There, for any given feedstock, there is a carbon content. There is a known efficiency of the power plant taking a fuel of that energy content, and I can produce the CO2 emissions. But for all the other emissions that we collect data on, mercury, sulfur, NOx, carbon monoxide, particulate emissions, those things are also are changing dynamically with the way this power plant operates, given whatever feedstock I'm feeding it, and also whatever emissions technology I've put on it. And it's not a nice linear system either. Every time I put on a new emissions control technology, I affect the efficiency of my power plant, right? And I put another filter on, right? It takes more energy to push the flue gas through that filter, and so I'm going to draw more coal and change the combustion characteristics of my plant. Right? So all these options, and really, this coal tech, you know, this could include bituminous. I'm on slide 37. All of these different options give us hundreds and possibly thousands of permutations. And obviously, we can't afford to do an Aspen model of every single one of those permutations. So what is the solution? And also, keep in mind that traditionally, life cycle assessment is just a linear programming model, right? There's an optimization objective, which is meet that one functional unit, 1 megajoule of fuel, 1 megawatt hour of power. And there's a set of constraints, which is how much, what the reference flow coming out of any given process is, right? So it's a linear programming model. There are some nonlinear processes happening within our world, but for the most part, we assume linearity. And generally, if it's not going to be linear, we're probably in the kind of meat of the curve where it at least looks linear. And so this linearity assumption is not terrible. Once I start getting into combustion characteristics, there's no question that this sucker's nonlinear. But yet I'm constrained by having a linear programming model that I need to populate. Right? So our initial thought here, and this is, I am saying this because we would like input on better ways to do this. My initial thought was, let's build kind of discrete matrices of performance characteristics and some associated kind of correlation matrices. So there would be a matrix which would say, as biomass percentage increases, I am going to decrease my process efficiency by X, right? So there's a matrix of those discrete values. And then I could assume linearity between them, let's say. But then there's also going to be a correlation table with, say, how the NOx emissions would change as that efficiency changed. And there would have to be a correlation table for every potential control technology. So I'm looking at it's workable, but I'm looking at a set of potentially dozens of relatively small matrices and virtually nothing to inform the information that would be in them. Which is problematic. Again, CO2 I can figure out. It's water use. It's SO2 production that are really problematic. And we're used to having 3 or 4 significant figures worth of precision. I'm happy to kind of get people's thoughts on how we might do this in some more efficient way. I'll kind of take those at the end, which I am at, by the way. And so last thing I want to leave you with on slide 38 is just all this information is available if you're interested. This is another eye chart. This is really just a talk about whether you can read small words.
All this information is available in at times excruciating detail. The website's there. These are all the documents and sort of the different types of studies, which, most of which I did not mention, which are available. And on the right are the sort of forthcoming things, information that we have coming available. So if any of these strike your fancy and you're interested in more detail, feel free to go explore on your own or come and talk to me. But yeah, I'll finish there and say, thank you very much for listening to me obfuscate these numbers. But I am interested in people's feedback, either on the data or on methods for this dynamic power plant that we have to build, because it is a bit of a daunting task. All the different permutations and the lack of information to inform those permutations is a bit daunting. So I'm happy if you guys have any input on those sorts of things as well. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, we have a bit of time for questions, and let me start by asking if there's anyone out there, if there are any questions for Joe.
Hey, Joe, this is Mike from NETL. can you guys hear me coming through?
Can you just wait until I'm on site? This is going to be hard, is it?
I hope not.
All right.
I don't think so. I just wanted to promote a little bit more discussion on one of the things that you started to touch on. You had brought up a really good example about the problems we run into when we're performing different methods of allocation, and, for example, the Fischer-Tropsch process.
Yeah.
I wanted to get your opinion and get you to talk a little bit about how that allocation issue might translate to the case where we now have CO2 capture from power plants that will be used for things like EOR or maybe something else, and would essentially create two products for your power plant, one being power and one being CO2. How might allocation issues affect that sort of scenario? Because as we see in the Fischer-Tropsch problem, on one allocation method, you have a very promising technology. With another allocation method, you might never choose to look at that again. So how might you think that translates to carbon capture and utilization?
Good question. So let's say, let's just pretend that we're going to live in the world of system expansion, because I think that probably might be a bit easier for folks to visualize. The key to whether or not, say, using system expansion versus energy or volume or mass-based allocation, the key to whether or not that's, and I'll use air quotes here even though you can't see them, sort of better for your process from a greenhouse gas perspective, depends on whether or not the co-products you're generating have a higher or lower carbon footprint than your product of interest, right? So if I am producing a megajoule of electricity, which has a carbon footprint, captured carbon footprint of, say, 200 grams CO2e per megajoule, and I'm taking my CO2 and putting it into the ground and producing conventional petroleum, which has a well, and actually the numbers here aren't going to – okay, no, they're fine. And I'm producing a conventional petroleum product, which has a carbon footprint of 80 grams per megajoule, I will see a decrease in overall system greenhouse gases allocated to my product because my co-product is less carbon intense than my product of interest. Now, if the reverse is true, if I am producing, say, a megajoule of natural gas power with a carbon footprint of I can't actually think of a counterexample, but you can imagine a situation where my product of interest would actually be higher carbon footprint than, or lower carbon footprint than the CO2 EOR product coming out, in which case my overall system expanded carbon footprint goes up because I'm now allocating to a higher carbon product. Unfortunately, there's no right answer, which is, I think, the crux of the problem. I mean, energy expansion or energy allocation, you know, from a chemical engineering perspective, it seems really neat and easy, right? These things all have an energy content. Can I just allocate the impact based on the energy content of my relative fuel, my fuel? So jet fuel gets a higher share of the impact because it's higher energy content than diesel. That just seems nice and neat.
But the reality is that we live in a world where these products are going out into a market and we're displacing things or possibly not displacing things. And system expansion might be a closer match to the reality outside your plant boundary. That's sort of a long answer, but the reality is it depends, of course, on what your product of interest is and what product slate you're going to produce.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah. Violet Yasek from Brasscamp. Just to get grounded as to what's actually being practiced in the industry today.
Sure.
Amongst very modern power plants that are being built, let's say natural gas.
Sure.
Are there any plants that are actually capturing 50, 60, 70% of that carbon? Are we looking really in the last 3-4 years, plants are capturing just a very small fraction?
So you probably wouldn't capture carbon from a natural gas plant right now. The CO2 concentration in the flue gas is not high enough to make it. But coal really is what we're talking about for carbon capture. We have to live in a heavily carbon constrained world for natural gas plants to start capturing their carbon. But let's take coal. There are industrial utility scale projects that are capturing carbon. There are also industrial-scale sequestration projects. Those two things aren't always connected to each other. So in that sense, they're effectively demonstrations of what the eventual system would look like. Because we've proven capture, we've proven sequestration. We don't have the infrastructure to prove kind of large scale of either of those things. And so... we tend to still be in the modeling world with those items. That being said, a huge amount of research is ongoing at the lab around these questions about whether or not these things can be done cost effectively. I'll go a bit off message and speak personally here. From a environmental perspective, I would prefer that coal goes away, right? I mean, I don't want it as a major part of our power portfolio or energy portfolio. But the reality is that it's a huge portion of our power portfolio. And to say something like, well, we should just install renewables instead, it's a environmentalist perspective. It's not an environmental engineering perspective. There's no reality to replacing 50% of our energy mix on any sort of reasonable time frame. And so the reality is we need a bridge. We need multiple bridges, right? So natural gas is one of those bridges, but it only gets us maybe, a 50% reduction, not an order of magnitude reduction. It's a little bit better. It's still a fossil fuel. Carbon capture gets us an order of magnitude sort of reduction. It goes from 2,000 pounds to 200 pounds of CO2e per megawatt hour at a cost. But there's a cost to all these things. And so, our job is to inform some of these questions and make sure that if we want a particular option, it's technically feasible. And I think that's what's happening at the lab right now, is kind of ensuring that these options are available if we need them.
Okay. Other questions? Well, perhaps I have one.
Sure.
You gave us a lot of case studies, which I found very interesting. This list is impressive here. And I'm kind of interested in, especially given the last topic you talked about, where you talked about this dynamic modeling.
Sure.
Power plants. Dynamic, I assume, being not in the sense of solving differential equations, but actually just looking at, looking at the life cycle when things change. Things change quickly.
But you're bringing up differential equations is great because, I mean, if I could develop the system of equations, we'd be golden. Okay. But I have no idea what any of those parameter values are. So that's the problem.
Okay, that's fine. Good. But I guess going back to this list, I'm really interested in the work process that goes on at NETL
sure.
to put a project like this together. You mentioned, for example, linear programming models
yep.
that you rely on. You also mentioned a few software packages that you use.
Sure.
And then also, I guess, underlying all of this is the sources of data or models
yep.
that, you know, kind of give you the numbers, go in there. So could you give us a little bit of a description about how that all takes place?
Sure.
And, yeah.
Okay, so the core function of the lab is pure research. And there is the vast majority of the budget goes into pure research. So there are people doing bench scale testing of these processes, right? So I'm going to, you know, produce a gasification unit that's going to take this type of coal, this type of biomass, and I'm going to measure those emissions. And then there is work actually taking that base benchmark bench data and sort of modeling what it would look like at utility scale, right? And then we have our Aspen modelers who take that information and model what all the emissions associated with that and the costs associated with that would be. And then there's us sitting at a layer above that, taking that Aspen type of data, plugging it into our life cycle models, producing associated life cycle costs associated with those things, and then pushing that information out to the public. Here is what all the different options we're researching look like, and then also pushing that information back down to the guys at the bench to say, your circulating fluidized bed technology, whether it's oxy-fired or not, costs 27 cents, right? It's just not workable when I can produce pulverized coal for 2 cents. So you need to figure out a way to get your bench-scale testing to be an order of magnitude cheaper.
If they can,
absolutely, right, yeah, and that's why it's, you know, inform the research program. I mean, yeah. we can't dictate. Although it would be nice to say, you know, produce a carbon free technology at 3 cents. You know, we don't have that.
Okay, and let me just follow up with a short thing. There's in the language of the national labs, there's this big program going on called verification and validation, V&V.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about how that impacts what you do.
I can't speak to that. I mean, I am...
Okay.
I respond directly to a particular client, right?
Okay.
And so there's no question that there are constraints on the federal employees that I am not subject to.
Okay.
Directly. I am only indirectly subject to those constraints. And so I can't... I can't speak to, you know, what the impact of those sorts of things are.
Okay, no, but I mean this idea of a valid...
This is Tim Scott at NETL. I can help out and answer that question.
Great, Tim.
Welcome, everybody. The verification and validation thrust within the National Lab Program
mm-hmm.
is a focus within the Office of Research and Development and more at the core bench scale and pilot scale testing and modeling efforts.
Okay.
That program is something that we feed information to. We're considered more of a subject matter experts on the analysis end.
Okay.
But those aspects don't directly apply in the context of the systems analysis, more high-level process work that we do. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't take those things into account and still apply the same ethics and principles in our modeling practice. It's that thrust area that you're referring to is something that's driven towards the lab scale folks within the Office of Research and Development.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Tim. It goes also to the question of validating these results against data and things like that. I know that's a difficult task, but it's a real question how that works with your program.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we produce. Let me just jump to one of our more populated figures. A figure like slide 27, we stand behind that result and we say, you know, look, this option is better than that option. And here we're actually not even though the uncertainty is characterized, it's not displayed here.
Right.
There's effectively, at our level, no validation mm-hmm. of those data, right? It's then maybe Mike's job to take our information, funnel it down to his modeling guys, and then those modeling guys' job to funnel it down and come for the information to come back up. I think, as Tim was saying, we're not directly constrained by it.
Okay, good. Other questions? All right, if not, then thanks, everyone, and sure. Let's thank Joe again.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and Tim and Mike, I really appreciate your setting this up, and I guess this concludes the seminar. Thanks.
Take care, guys.